As for the youngsters, I think Jenny Buckley is, she's the next star. I was always sort of afraid that I'm going to be lost once I'm done competing, because it is such a big part of your identity, like at that level. It's all you do. It's all you think about. My wife was pregnant most of the 24 seasons. So I was so excited. Yeah. To get a baby and
I wonder if I try hard. I don't know. I gotta think about it.
I don't want to be mean, but I'm sure you're not.
Welcome to another episode of the That's Not Real Climbing podcast. I'm your host, Jenny, and I'm excited to introduce my guest for today, Gregor Vizonic. Gregor is a boulder and lead climber from Team Slovenia, but he recently retired a few months ago from competitions. In this episode, we'll get insight into the powerful Slovenian team, how he made the decision to retire and all the planning around it, what it's like climbing with Janja, and we get to hear him geek out about holds and hold shaping. It was really exciting for me to hear about how much love and psych he still has for the comp scene, so I hope you enjoy this episode with Gregor. Real quick, I'm excited to announce my new sponsor helping make this podcast episode possible, Mad Rock Climbing. I got fitted with their brand new line of high-performance shoes, the D2.1s. They just came out December 6th, but you might notice a few of your favorite GOM climbers are already wearing them, like Oscar Beaudrand from Team Canada, and also me. This is the first time I've gotten to wear their shoes for an extended period of time, and I'm actually super impressed with the grip of their in-house rubber, and of course, the famous drone heel that everyone says is the cheat code to heel hooking small edges. Feel free to message me if you have any questions about the shoes or sizing, and you can use the discount code NOTREALCLIMBER for 10% off your entire Mad Rock order. Info will be in the description. Back to the show. Where are you at right now?
I'm at a climbing gym.
It looks very clean. Oh, okay. For a climbing gym.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Were you setting today?
I was, yeah. I was setting in the morning. Was working on a spray wall, actually.
Setting on a spray wall?
Yeah. Setting the spray wall, like resetting it.
Huh. What goes into setting like a spray wall? Or can you just like put stuff up wherever? Or do you actually have to like think about it?
I think most people don't know how to use spray wall, so it's really hard for them to like set spray wall as well. But I think, a lot of thought goes into setting a spray wall.
Really? Okay. Yeah, I always thought you just, like, throw whatever old holds you have up there, no?
No, it's not like that. It's just, the way I do it is I start at the bottom, like, the quarter, and then I go from there, because I feel like in 1 square meter, there should be all type of grip types and, like, directions and all of that. So a lot goes in, yeah.
So you've like seen a lot of like bad spray walls then?
I think most of the spray walls are bad.
Ooh, okay. Starting out with a hot take already. Okay, so what's like a bad spray wall versus a good one?
I mean, it depends what you want, right? Like who the people are going to be, they're going to be climbing on it. But if you're setting for like a high level, most spray walls have too many jugs on it. Most spray walls have the footholds that are too good. A good sign of a bad spray wall is also like in like one small spot you have very similar holds turned into very like similar directions. So if you have like 3 pinches that are all in the like kind of diagonal, that's not good because it just doesn't offer as much as it could. It was funny, a couple of years ago I saw the new training, like USA Climbing Training Center for the first time. Mm. It was the one that they just moved. And Nathaniel Coleman and Ben Hannock kind of took me through the whole thing. And they showed me the spray wall and the boulders and stuff. And they were super psyched about it because obviously it's a really good place. And they were like, oh, what do you think of the spray wall? I was like, I think it's shit. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that good. Yeah. And at first they thought I was joking. And then we started talking about it and like we kind of like, and then I talked to Josh as well and he was like, oh yeah, we have to change a lot of things because it's not ideal. It's not like optimal.
So did they change it after?
They did, yeah.
Okay, nice.
They did. And like the last few years that I've seen it, it's like now it's really good. And I'm not saying I'm the person that changed it or anything. I just, it's gotten like significantly better every year that I see it now. Yeah.
Well, that's good for us, I guess. Yeah, that's interesting to know. I mean, I don't really climb on a spray wall that often because I don't think I climb at a high enough level where it's like I don't run out of things in the gym. So then I'm like, I don't really like having to memorize holds on a spray wall, so I'm going to avoid it. So yeah, I guess I never really thought about it, but yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so I guess getting into your background a little bit, just starting from the beginning, how did you get started climbing and competing?
Yeah, so I was born into a climbing family. My parents are both climbers. They met in a crag, and then my brother is a competition climber. So yeah, I was just kind of born into it. I was in the crags, yeah. So I spent most of my childhood outside in crags, climbing, playing under the rocks and stuff.
How old were you when you started like competing? Because I guess it doesn't sound like your parents competed.
My dad actually, I'm not sure if my mom competed, but my dad did compete. He was, he competed at the first Yugoslavian national championships in...
Whoa.
I think it was in 86, and he got third.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah. I remember he had this little cup that he got, and he was so proud of it. And then I started bringing home medals and stuff, and he was like, oh, I still have my cup.
Aw.
But yeah. So I started competing nationals when I was 8 or 9. I think 9, but I did like divisionals and regionals before that. I started competing when I was young, but I started climbing even before that.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I don't remember the time when I wasn't climbing.
So I didn't actually start watching comps until maybe like, it's like kind of recent, like maybe 2021 or 2022. So is your brother older, I would assume?
He is older, but he never actually competed at a World Cup level. So,
okay,
yeah.
Gotcha. Well, I guess since he also competed, did you ever feel like competitive against each other or like... against your dad?
Oh, yeah.
Anything like that?
I mean, my brother for sure. Like when I started like training a bit harder, I guess when I was like 10, 11, whatever, and he was still training and he was good. Like we never could train together. There's like, I don't think we ever did a training session together.
Wow.
We were super competitive against each other. Also, we're like very different people and how you approach life. So we just, yeah. Also, it's like, yeah, you know, like we're brothers 4 years apart. So, I think it's kind of tough for boys that age to really get along as brothers.
Oh, really?
Especially if you're in like a competitive environment as we were. Yeah, we were both competition climbers.
I mean, although I guess if you're 4 years apart, you're not really competing against each other in like the same category or anything like that.
Yeah, we weren't in the same category, but, yeah, I do feel like there was competition between us.
I see. Who was like the... Was there like anger involved? Is it like... Or like, what did that look like?
I don't think there was like actual anger, but it's just like... I don't know. It's hard to explain. I think we just have such a different outlook to life that we also approach climbing differently. And that's why it just never worked. Which like now looking back, I'm kind of sad we didn't do it. Because, we could have learned from each other, I guess. But yeah, it just didn't happen and that's okay.
I mean, are you guys like still competitive nowadays or?
No.
Okay.
No, we're quite close now.
Okay.
It's very different now. Yeah.
What would you say is like his approach to climbing versus yours that's so different?
He was always kind of like... really into being like super strong, doing one arm pull-ups, like just campusing stuff, and I was more of a, because I'm naturally really weak, so I had to rely on all other stuff, and I was studying climbing a lot, like the movement and you know all these sorts of stuff. So I think that's the main difference that we had. And he was like this big jacked dude, like had huge biceps, and I was a skinny kid, no muscles.
Huh. Well, it's interesting you would say that, like, naturally you're weak, but like you guys are brothers, so same kind of genes, right?
Yeah. I think it's just because I think he started training when he was like actual training when he was younger than me, and so I was more I was sort of like just climbing, as you know, doing it as a fun activity. I had other stuff going on, and he was like really early on, he was really focused just on climbing. And so he was actually training, and I was more sort of like just climbing, discovering movement and playing around. So I think because he started doing that so early, he developed like more muscles, he got stronger, and I just didn't. So yeah, I guess same genes, but different approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting to know. Okay. So you're kind of like, well, you are the first Slovenian athlete that I've interviewed. So I kind of have some general questions about climbing in Slovenia. It's a pretty small country. So what do you think makes the team so dominant? Is there like a long climbing history there?
Yeah, I mean, the country is really small. There's like 2 million of us. But the history is, we have so much history of, you know, alpinists and then rock climbers and then competition climbers. I think there's like three things that make the team so good. Like, first of all, I think because we've had competition climbers for so long, you know, we have a long history of the of coaching as well. So our coaches are very knowledgeable. So they basically know what they're doing. They know how to train. And I feel like that knowledge has been transferred from the old coaches to the new coaches for the last, I don't know, 25, 30 years, maybe even, 35 years. We have really good coaches. Secondly, because the country is so small and we've had, you know, successful competitors since like forever, I think we had a first world champion, Martina Čufar. She won world championships, I want to say 2003. And after that, we've had, you know, like, and before that, we had Alyosha Grom, who was on a World Cup podium. And after that, obviously, we had like so many good competitors. And I feel like because the country is so small, there is like a really big chance you're going to interact with those people. So, you know, if you're close to someone who's that good, it just kind of makes you realize that, you know, it's possible. The person who's winning the World Cup is also just a human. They're not like some freaks that you like, they're not doing something that's not possible for you. Yeah. And then thirdly, I think we have like a really good program from when we're kids to when we're adults. So basically, like for me, I joined the youth team, like the national youth team, when I was 13 or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because we have such a good tradition of training and coaching, when I was 13, I was kind of put into this environment where everybody was training, and that's what, like, I kind of understood what training means, what you need to do to be good. And then it sort of like, for me, became a way of life. And if you start to develop this, like, these habits that are going to make you successful in the future, and you just like keep doing that for years and years and years, and if you have whatever, if you're going to throw 25 kids into the youth team or 30, you know, those are already handpicked, and then if you have like 25-30 talents in the team, eventually they're going to be good when they're 21, 22 or whatever, 25. So I think these are the three main things that make us good. Because in reality, like, infrastructure was really bad until like a couple of years ago. Because we still only have, I'll have to count them. I think we have like seven commercial gyms in the country, but we probably have 30 different spray walls, you know?
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I see you are the spray wall expert then. Okay.
Or maybe even like 50 spray walls. I don't know. But it's just like people are training. There's a lot of small clubs and they all have reasonably good training programs. And also like at a very young age, like you're just so close to everybody who's competing. So, you know, you sort of like kids sort of feed off each other. and learn stuff from each other. And they get it, like they have a chance to climb together more often than kids in the US, because they live, you know, like a 6-hour flight apart.
Yeah.
Here, you know, here everything is 2 hours away.
So you like grow up just training on a spray wall instead of like commercial gyms?
Oh yeah. I grew up training on a spray wall. Absolutely. I like my parents are both climbers. So we would drive to Austria a lot. Also, I grew up, you know, 5 kilometers or 6 kilometers from the Austrian border, and they did have a lot of commercial gyms, but it was mostly elite. So like for me, we would drive to Austria reasonably like a lot. Yeah. Like reasonably frequent. But other than that, it was just like spray walls all the time.
Yeah. I find it interesting that people would be interested in getting into climbing if they only have access to a spray wall.
Yeah. Well, I think you're looking at it from sort of
a
your
US
bubble,
because
I'm assuming you don't have a lot of, I don't actually know, but what's the closest rock climbing crag to you? Like how far do you have to drive?
Well, I don't climb outside, so I actually don't know. Half an hour? Yeah.
Okay, like where I grew up, there's like probably like 12 crags within 20 minutes with a car.
Oh, okay, I see.
So I like a lot of climbers in Slovenia up to recently kind of grew up rock climbing. We're only now, like the last 7 years, or, you know, maybe we're racking, maybe it's been longer, but... Because I feel like in the US, you guys have like I would assume the majority of climbers are indoor climbers.
Yeah.
In Slovenia, that's true, yeah. The majority of climbers is rock climbers. So maybe, you know, the spray wall is not the thing that kind of drives you in, but sort of like rock climbing gets you in. And then because you want to get better at rock climbing, you have the spray walls that are going to make you better.
And then does the Slovenian team like train together a lot?
Yeah. We do have, because we also have the training center in Ljubljana, in our capital. And there's like we have it for the last three or four years. But even before that, we trained together a lot. But even before that, we trained together a lot. Like now, I feel like every week there's new boulders. There's like comp simulation. There's like, yeah, just there's a lot of stuff you can train on. And most of the people on the team live kind of like, you know, close to the training center, like an hour drive maximum. So, I mean, obviously it's really good to train with people that are on a high level.
Yeah, they're going to push you.
Yeah.
And then in terms of, I guess, like athlete funding, I know it varies a lot country to country. So did you feel like you were able to make a full living just being an athlete?
Yeah, in Slovenia, it's actually like really good. We do complain a lot, but I think because we did complain a lot. I'm not part of the team anymore, but I think we got spoiled. But in reality, if you are selected for the comps, everything is going to be funded, so you don't spend any money. Also, once you get to, when you get to a certain level, if you're lucky enough, you're going to get employed by the government. So there's like most of the athletes on the team are employed by the army. I was employed by the police, which means, you know, you get salary, you get insurance paid, social security, whatever, you know, everything is like you're an employee.
Okay, that's good.
And I mean, you're not gonna be like, once you're done with comms, you're not gonna be a rich person from it, but
yeah
you're making a living. It's not like you're spending money for climbing. You may see you are a professional.
Yeah.
So it's really good.
Okay, and so I guess as you're exiting, who on the Slovenian team do you think is going to be one to watch out for coming up the ranks?
I think there's, you know, the usual suspects that have been on the scene for so long. You know, you got the Janja, Vita, Luchka, Mia, Luca, and all the rest. You've done so well in the past. I don't think things are going to change drastically in the next few years. As long as they compete, they're all on a really high level. As for the youngsters, I think Jenny Buckley is...
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, I think she's the next star. I just talked to her recently. I don't think she's just like super talented. I think she's also like very mature for her age, has the like work ethics, and if all goes well, if she stays healthy and everything, I think she's got a really bright future. And I'm sure I'm missing people out. To be honest, I'm not that involved with the youth team, so
fair, yeah, that's true.
It was really fun. I was setting a youth simulate, like, for I'm setting a lot for the team now, and I like a month ago I was setting for the youth team, and I was like, oh, I want to see who's coming, so I just know the level and stuff, and I checked the list. I was like, oh my god, I don't know anyone. I should get more involved. I was like, yeah.
Well, now you know a little better after setting for them, I guess.
Yeah. No, it's gotten significantly better in the last month. So
going back a little bit again to your like competition career, what do you feel like was your career highlight?
There's the obvious two, I think, winning World Cup and podium at the World Championships.
Is there anything that's like not a win that really stands out to you?
There's a couple of comps where I did like reasonably well, but going there, I was like, I felt like shit. I was tired. I had pain. And I remember, I'm not going to remember which year it was, but it was like one of the Meiringen comps. It was the first comp of the season. I felt like shit for 3 weeks before the comp. I didn't make finals at the National Cup. I had pain in my shoulder. I was like, why am I going to this comp? I even had like a conversation with Roman, my coach, like, should I be going to this comp? And then I got there, kind of switched it on, and ended up eighth or ninth, which is not too bad.
Yeah, feels pretty good.
So there's like a couple of comps like that where we'd go to Asia, and I wouldn't sleep, felt like shit, you know, but still kind of switched it on and had a good result. Those were always special, but because the result was not the podium finish,
you don't remember it as
maybe
much.
They aren't.
Any like traveling highlights?
There's everything was a highlight.
Really? Well, the traveling part.
Yeah, it's just such an amazing life to live. Like you get to travel the world, you see all these amazing places, you're traveling with your friends, and you get to do the thing you love the most. And for some years in between, I was kind of like sick of it. But I was just like, maybe me being too obsessed with the results and not like looking at a bigger picture and being like, okay, I'm super privileged to be doing this. This is all amazing. But it's very easy to get like, because you just get so blindsided. You just, the only thing you see are results in climbing, and it's but I feel like all of my years traveling global and competing was all a highlight for sure.
I mean, yeah, because like sometimes if you are like nervous for a competition, I'm sure you don't even really get to experience the traveling part.
Most of the time, at least for me, that's how I function. Is like, I would go to a comp, and like a lot of the time people on the team would like make fun of me that I'm gonna run out of vitamin D, because like we would get somewhere, you know, stay in the hotel, go training, and then go back to the hotel. I'm a very picky eater, so a lot of the time I would just eat in my hotel room. I wouldn't even go to restaurants. I think I've been to Tokyo, I want to say 8 times, and I've never explored Tokyo. Like people ask me how Japan is. Yeah, it's good, but in reality, I've never explored it that much.
Okay.
It was just like, but it's, I'm not saying everyone's doing that. It was just my comfort zone. That's how I felt like I should be functioning. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Yeah.
Well, so then if you didn't actually experience any of the traveling part, then what did you like about traveling?
I still experienced it more than not being there. You know what
okay.
I mean?
I wasn't,
I was traveling the world, but I wasn't a traveler. You know, I wasn't going there on vacation. I wasn't exploring different cities. Yeah, a tiny bit, yes. But still, you know, you get just, even if you like, if you're just in the hotel room, if you're driving around the city, you still get to experience different cultures, different cities and countries.
I find it interesting that you're a picky eater, because I also feel like I'm kind of a picky eater. So sometimes traveling gets weird. But I feel like it's really hard if you need to like stay fueled and like compete and perform. So when you're traveling, did you have like a go-to meal that is like good for that? Because I would love to know.
I think I was pretty bad with my diet, like, to be honest. I don't think it was a well-balanced diet, because like, I'm a vegetarian. So, you know, by all scientific data, I'd have to be like filling up on protein differently. And I wasn't really taking care of that. I remember like I ate a lot of like instant ramen stuff.
Oh, wow. For competitions. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I would have like protein bars and stuff, but I don't think I was a very good example of what an athlete's diet should look like.
So yeah. You didn't even have like vegetables before a competition?
No, obviously, okay. Like I'll have vegetables and you know, fruit and all that stuff, but yeah, not ideal. Yeah.
So as a picky eater, what's like the most popular food that people like that you can't stand?
I mean, meat is a big one, isn't it?
Well, I don't think fish, you can say that you're a vegetarian, so that makes you a picky eater. Like usually picky eater is like, oh, you don't like food just because it like tastes bad or something.
Eggplants, olives.
Okay, nice.
There's a really weird one. I get like really bad migraines, like going to the hospital bed, and I figured one of my triggers is cheese.
Uh-huh. That's fair.
So I haven't had cheese in like 8 years. And that's like, it's like, imagine going to France and you can't eat cheese, or going to Italy, mm-hmm. and it's like everything's cheese infused. So that's like, oh, it's such a pain in the ass, you know. Like you go to a pizzeria and then like, well, I guess I'm going to have pizza without cheese.
Well, does it like work? Like you don't have those migraines anymore?
It's getting better. It's not just connected to that. I think it's like connected to a lot of things. They're also, I've heard they're like, how do you call that? Like you sort of get them from your parents or grandparents.
I mean, I do too, so.
Ah, okay.
And I think my dad does, so.
Yeah. I've been to the Salt Lake City hospital twice because of the migraine. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So it's like happened during comps.
Yeah. There was only one comp that I couldn't do because of a migraine. Salt Lake City was always a tough one for me. I don't know why. Maybe it's the air quality. Maybe it's the travel because it's kind of far.
Elevation maybe.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the elevation there is, but yeah.
No, yeah, I relate to that. Can't imagine what it'd be like doing competitions with a migraine. That would be really bad.
It's impossible, yeah.
I guess, like, what happened in Salt Lake, it just, like, hits and then you just...
Yeah. There's, like, 3 years ago, I had to... Our qualities, when they were in the afternoon and in the morning, I got one. And, like, all the time I was lying in the hospital, I was like, okay, this is going to get better. I'm going to get ready for, like, these qualities. And then I just didn't, which sucked because I traveled to Salt Lake to lay in bed for 5 days.
Oh, it was for that long. Wow.
Yeah. Or maybe it was four. It didn't last that long, but I was kind of, like, not functioning properly for, like, yeah, a couple of days. Yeah, they suck. I don't actually like talking about them.
Well, I'm just curious about your experience. I guess we don't have to go on, but it's just like, yeah, I don't know that many other people who get them that bad. Mine are not that bad. Like mine are stoppable with like prescription medication, which is good.
Mine are not. And sometimes I can't speak anymore. Sometimes I remember like a couple of times when it happened abroad, I was just like, I don't know how to speak English anymore. Like, and then I was like, so I'd have to have someone else talk to the staff because I'm just like, one time I thought I was having a stroke because I couldn't speak.
You get like the whole, all of the side effects, like auras, yeah, like nausea.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Fun times. Yeah.
I guess in that case, it's like pretty impressive still able to like still being able to do competitions, because I always feel like, oh, it's so annoying, like it takes away so many days from my training. Yeah,
but yeah, like to be fair, they were never that like they didn't happen that often, like they weren't that frequent, so yeah, got quite lucky with that.
Well, yeah, thanks for sharing that was good for me to know. Okay, so now going into like your retirement process, what went into making your decision to retire? It's definitely not an easy decision to make. Please excuse this brief intermission, but if you're interested in deleted scenes from this episode where we talk about transitioning from outdoors to competitions and setting for youth climbers, do consider helping support this podcast on Patreon. Some other perks include a membership pin shipped to you after 2 months, prioritized guest questions, or the ability to submit video questions, and more to come. The proceeds go back into the podcast to help me break even, and they help me improve the experience of the guests. If you'd like to help out non-monetarily, liking, commenting, and sharing helps a great deal as well. Back to the show.
It's a really hard decision. But I've sort of always had, like, I don't know why, but for some reason I've always kept like thinking like 10 years ahead, like what I want to achieve. But
it's a good thing.
What I imagined my life would be like in, you know, the next 10 years, and like sort of the milestones I want to hit. And I think I've had the idea of quitting in 2024 since 2018 or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. I was like, okay, I'm not going to be doing Tokyo Olympics. If the format changes, I might have a small chance of making Paris. Paris would be a good way to stop the career. But I was always like, okay, even if I don't make Paris, because I always knew the chances are really small. Maybe I thought the chances are too small, and that's why I wasn't even close. I was always like, okay, yeah, like 2024 is the year I'm done. I'll be 29 years old, and then, you know, I have so much stuff to do in my life. So yeah, sort of always had that plan. When 2024 came, it wasn't the hard decision, because I've always knew that was going to happen. What was hard was in like 2023, when I had like a really bad season. I was like, okay, should I be like, why am I doing this for one more year? I was sort of contemplating if I should just quit or... So that was tough, but once the last comp came in 2024, I was just like, I was very okay with the decision. Well, I also like kind of prepared my life in terms of like, I knew the stuff that I'll be doing once I'm done with my career. I kind of laid the groundwork. So
yeah.
Also, like my wife was pregnant most of the 24 seasons, so I was so excited to get a baby. And it wasn't like it was obviously very emotional at the last comp, but still I was not like sad that I'm leaving. And and before the season started, I was also like very, it's like, okay, this is my last season. I'm going to like enjoy everything, like everything, mm-hmm. everything, and stay in the moment and everything. So, sort of, I was like saying goodbye to this life for like a year. And it was good. It was good.
That's good to know like ahead of time. Did you feel like relief whenever it was over, or just like bittersweet, or happy?
No, I didn't feel the relief. I didn't feel bittersweet. I was just like very satisfied with how my career ended. Yeah, it was just like, this is it. Now it's time to do all other stuff. I'm very happy I had this life. I feel very privileged. I got to experience all that. And so, yeah, I was just satisfied.
Yeah. Did you have any like fears before retiring about what would come after or what you would do?
I honestly don't think I did, just because I was always sort of afraid that I'm going to be lost once I'm done competing, because it is such a big part of your identity, like at that level. It's all you do. It's all you think about. So because I was afraid that that's going to happen to me, I did like lay the groundwork and prepared. Yeah, I sort of prepared myself. I started the climbing hold brand, you know. I was just like, okay, now. And I knew I wanted to be a setter. So I was like, okay, I'm not walking away from something. I'm walking towards something. And
that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, so it was, like, for me, it was just like really good experience.
And like now that you're a few months out, how does it feel?
I've been so busy with everything. I don't really think.
You don't feel. Okay.
I didn't have time to think about it. Also, I've been very involved with like the Slovenian team, with setting, and most of my best friends are on the team anyway. So I talk to them. I know I'm still very much involved in the competition scene. So I don't feel like I'm not outside that much. I do wonder what's going to happen when the season starts and I'll be looking at World Cups, but I think I'll just be like psyched to watch my friends compete and do well. And it's all good. It's all good.
Makes sense. Are you still going to like travel, or are you just like watch online?
I don't think I'll be watching any of the comps this year. Obviously Koper, yeah, the one in Slovenia, like the elite comp, I'll watch that.
Watch as in like go in person?
Yeah. Like okay. Everything else I'll probably just watch like streams. It also depends like where I'll be globally, because I'll be traveling quite a lot in next year, so maybe some of the travels sort of cross with the comps, but we'll see.
And so I guess in a more general sense, well, also like congrats on having a baby. That's really exciting.
Thank you.
And I'm glad that you're excited for it. In a more general sense, with like all the new stuff you're working on and like also being a new parent, that's like a huge time commitment. How do you come to terms with no longer being able to perform at your best? Especially, I feel like for a lot of younger listeners who are still in a phase where you're supposed to like constantly improve. I mean, even just for like newer climbers, you're supposed to like always be improving. Plateaus are like the worst thing in the world for a lot of people. Like the thought of not improving or like even declining is kind of like terrifying. Not that you're declining, like you're certainly still one of the top athletes.
No, I am.
But you know what I mean?
I can identify with being like very frustrated when the plateaus happen, when you're not feeling that good. I remember like, I think about it now, it's like most of the days when I was in a bad mood or wasn't really psyched on life, and not even in the depressed way, but when I was just unhappy with myself, was because of the feeling I got on the wall. So like I was very, very it defined me a lot, like how good I'm climbing. But I feel like now with saying goodbye to comps, I sort of also said goodbye to being strong. I'm not very frustrated when I'm not strong. The only time I get frustrated if I feel bad is when I'm setting, but not in a way that I'm shit, I can't do that move. It's more like, oh, I wish I was stronger. This, you know, it would make the job so much easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if you're setting at a high level, it's like, there's a difference if you have to try a move 4 times to get the feeling of it, or if you can get close in the first try. So the only reason, like, I'm taking April off setting because I want to train, because I feel like I sort of worked too much and didn't train at all. So I'm taking April off just to get back in shape, sort of. I'll never be in the shape I was, but just to make setting easier, because I also feel like I owe it to the athletes that I'm setting for.
So I guess the way you kind of got over that feeling was just, it was no longer your life. Like, you didn't define yourself, I guess, by how you were climbing.
Yeah. It's also like a lot of like comp climbers, when they're done with their career, they're like, they still train hard because they want to do hard stuff outside. It is sort of sad, but I'm not that psyched to do hard stuff outside. Maybe because I'm too much into setting and just this whole industry. I do hope I get psyched for rock climbing again, because I think it's like a really good way of living your life. But I'm not like specifically training to do stuff outside. It's I'm just not motivated for it, and I've come to terms with it. Even though my 16-year-old self would hate me. But it's just how I feel at the moment and how my life works right now. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, you can make more money setting than you can climbing outside, I guess. So
yeah, but it's not, I mean, I'm not looking at rock climbing as a way of making me, making a living. You know, it's just like, in my head, when I was younger, I've always had this idea, okay, when I stop competing, I'll be climbing hard stuff outside. Not necessarily as a way of making money. It's just like, I was psyched to do hard stuff. Now I'm just not.
No, I think that makes sense. I mean, like, as a kid, before I had money, I was like, when I have money, I'm going to buy RuneScape Premium and I'm going to play that all day. And then I never ended up doing that. So I think it makes sense. It's a fair. So yeah, now that you are doing more setting, how are you liking it compared to just competing?
I feel like before, looking at like a round, let's say a comp simulation, I haven't done that many competitions, but like I haven't set that many competitions, but set like quite a lot of training stuff now. Is before it was just like, how can I, there was a round, okay, and I did whatever, one boulder, two boulders, whatever. Before I was like, okay, how do I improve, like how do I change as a setter, as a climber to do better next time. And now I'm just like, after a round, like how do I improve as a setter to offer the athletes a better training or a better competition. So it's a before I was thinking about performance, and now I just think about the product on the wall.
Did you set while you were climbing too, or competing?
Not in the last 6 years, because I didn't have to, like, money wise. But basically, I started setting when I was really, really young. I think I set my first competition when I was probably like 12 years old or something.
Whoa. Okay.
Also, when I started training a bit harder, and nobody at the local club was really that strong, so the spray wall was kind of easy. Like, very quickly, I started changing the spray wall. So I think my first setting experience, I was probably like 10, 11 years old. And because my dad was also such like an important part of the club, he sort of showed me how to do stuff. And I've been setting for a long time. And 2015, 16, 17, I did a lot of setting. Just because, it was a way. Basically, what I did is, after the season, I would go somewhere, set for like a month when I had my off season, just to make enough money to, to make it through 6-7 months of competition a season.
How much do you feel like setting while competing helped versus hurt? Because I could see how setting while competing maybe helps you get into the mindset of what the setter wants, but it's also like so physical, so like it takes away from training.
I mean, if you want to be doing like, you're not going to be a successful competitor if you're going to be setting, multiple days a week. But if you do get into setting when you're young, and you do, once a month or whatever, you try to sort of experience with moves, you are going to understand the movement better. So you're going to become a better climber. You're going to be reading routes from boulders better because you kind of understand what the setter's process was. And I feel like for me, it helped a lot, especially in like slabs and coordination stuff. If you are a setter, you look at a move and you see how the holds are positioned and you do get the idea how it should be working. And I think it helps. It shouldn't be a regular thing because it's a physical job. And if you're setting six, seven hours a day, to train after that it's impossible. I mean, you can do it for some times, but if you're going to be doing this for like a couple of months, couple of years, it's not going to work. You're going to be too tired. It's too physical.
Any aspirations of like becoming an IFSC setter one day?
Yeah, I really want to get into it. First of all, I still want to be part of the scene. Because I like the community so much. I also think comps are the coolest thing ever. Like,
oh, nice. That's good.
And I also like, I love setting. Like, setting is basically, it's my hobby. I wouldn't say it's my job because, yeah, it's not. My primary job is, you know, having a whole brand. I'm doing setting because I really want to be setting.
And, yeah, that's good to hear.
And I feel like, you know, if you're a timer, the highest level you can compete, like the highest level you can achieve as a competitor is, you know, World Cups. And it's same for setters, like the highest level you can compete, like you can get to as a setter is the World Cup. So yeah, I want to be trying out concepts. I want to be putting stuff on the wall for the best climber in the world, basically, and see what's possible.
That's really good to hear. I mean, even though like I'm doing a comp climbing podcast, I feel like a lot of the people I even interview are like, I rarely hear that someone say that they think comps are the coolest thing ever. So that's good to
hear.
Yeah,
I have my problems with like formats, or format is a bad case, but I do see problems with comps, but I still think like getting the strongest climbers in the world together and have them fight it out. And like, there's some moments that happen where you're like, how did this just happen? This is incredible. And yeah. And I do also, like, I respect the commitment of the athletes so much because I know how much they're putting in. And then to see what the level is, like where you can get and the stuff you can do if you really commit, it's so cool.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Okay, and you talked about the hold shaping. That's your, I guess, your main thing. For those who don't know, which I feel like is probably a lot of people. I mean, I don't really know anything about hold shaping. How does it work?
Basically, it's you get a block of foam. It's a sort of foam, and then you can either kind of sculpt it, carve it by hand, you use all these different tools, and then they make the mold, whatever, that's totally different process. Or you can shape the hold on your computer. I don't know how that works. I'm really bad with computers, and then have like a CNC machine cut it out. But it's basically, yeah, it's all the stuff you see on the wall, somebody had to come up with. And yeah, it was, most of the stuff is shaped by hand on like a foam block.
Well, so that's just the shaping process, but then the actual production is just like regular factory stuff.
Yeah. That's like totally different. Like, I feel like a lot of the shapers are basically just sculptors. They're artists who are producing stuff. I don't think I'm an artist. I think I'm really actually pretty bad at I think I've done some good stuff, but I wouldn't say I'm talented. But like, some shapes that I see are just like, this is artwork. But it's also like, by the end of the day, it can't just be artwork. It has to be a product, so it has to be functioning as well. So it's like product design. It's very similar to setting, because you know, you can put stuff on the wall, it's gonna look pretty, you know, you can recreate the flower with holes or whatever. But that's art. But as a setter, you have to create a product that's going to function. So I feel like it's a very, very similar process with shaping. It's like you're an artist, but at the same time, you're a product designer. So the product has to work.
I guess, like, are there any specific shapes or holds that come to mind that really stand out to you?
There's so much stuff that I like.
Okay.
I find it quite incredible. Like, there's some of the flat hold stuff, like the Relilo set. I'm pretty sure it's like 14 years old. It's still getting used today. And it's a very simple shape, but it still works so well. And then you have like the Enterprise, now Cheetah shape, like the big Taji. That was shaped like 15 years ago. Still works amazingly. And or if you look at like 360 stuff, it's like, it's just like most of their stuff is just a circle.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so simple, but yeah, it works so well, and they keep coming up with new stuff in that shape. But then on the other hand, you got stuff like, I can get really into details. I'm like super nerdy about climbing holds.
Yeah.
It's like, if you look at some of the stuff that people have been doing with like recreating rock types, if you look at like Bluestone, which is not very common in the US, but if you look at like the details on their font range, it's like the hole looks exactly like a piece of rock in font. Or if you look at Kilter's granite range, it's just like, how do you do that? I get nerdy. Like every time I walk into a gym, and it's been like that since forever, I would go around, just touch the holes, and like some stuff I'm just like, how is this so comfortable?
So it's about like comfort and ergonomics, and
it is, but it's also like function, you know, it's function, and it's just it's so much. It's, if you think about like some people find root setters like super creative and they're like, oh, how did you do that? But if you take like even like a step back, somebody had to create the product that then the setters are going to use. So it's like, for me, shaping is sort of like one level or one step before the setting even starts. So it's sort of like carving out a piece of foam, but already thinking about the movement is going to make it possible.
Okay. So, I mean, I know you had listened to my episode with Nikki and Jake, and they had some old opinions. I also listened to when you were on their podcast. And I was glad to hear you call it out. That was a good moment for me. I was happy to hear that. So clearly some people have strong opinions on holds. And I think they had also said, I had asked, like, is there a hold that doesn't exist that needs to exist? And they vehemently said no. So in terms of like continuing to shape holds, what more needs to be out there?
I don't think that there's like an answer to that question, because it's sort of like asking, you know, a chef what sort of a pasta shape do we need? And we're all like, we have all the pasta shapes we need, but yet every now and then there's a new pasta shape that changes how pasta is character. Do we need more dishes, like actual food? No, we don't. But yet people come up with new dishes every year. So it's the same. It's like in inventing something new. I think there's like unlimited potential. Although I do think there's not, now we're sort of stuck in brands just copying each other, sort of like following the trends. Which I'm not going to shit on that, because I think I'm guilty of that as well. And I think it's just, in reality, it's just very hard to create something new.
Yeah.
But there is, I'm sure there is stuff, no, outside, just outside of shaping as well. There's like new materials we have to try. There's all these sorts of stuff that we have to play around with. It's also like, as the sport's going to progress, it's like, we're going to notice, okay, what, I'm sure like there's a setter who's going to come up with a new move or whatever, new sequence, and they're going to be like, oh, I don't have the the right equipment to do that. And then, you know, a shaper is going to come up with that and they're going to make that possible. But yes, there's too many whole brands in the world. I think the market's pretty saturated right now. And yes, a lot of the stuff has been discovered in the past. But I think there's going to be new cool stuff coming up anyway. It's sort of like, a person asked me the other day, like, why do you come up with a new range every year? Like, do you need that? I was like, no, but, you know, BMW makes a new car every year. And it's, or not, like, Apple makes new iPhone every year. It's just like, it's just sort of better. And then over the time, stuff is just going to get better. And yeah, I'm still very, very psyched for shaping.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. I think that kind of goes into one of the questions that came through on Instagram, which was, what's your creative process when designing a new hold? And how long does it take to move it into production?
It's like very different from time to time. You know, sometimes it's very quick. Sometimes it's very long. It's like, for me, there's like two types of shaping that I do. There's like shaping for myself and shaping for my own brands, or the shaping that I do for other brands. If I do stuff for other brands, normally people come to me and they're like, this is what we want. Can you make 100, 200, 300 of these? Just different for variations. Can you make a range? And that's like, there's not a lot of creativity. Yeah, there's not a lot of creativity there. But when it comes to like creating a new range for myself, it can come from anything. You know, it can come from talking to a friend about like holds, talking to a setter about moves. It can come from just, like, a lot of the times it would just come from, you know, playing with the foam, sort of like, it's like, it is so closely connected to the tools that you're using. So it's just like, you're trying to do something new with a tool and there's like this small detail that comes up and you're like, okay, this detail could be the identity of the whole range. But I feel like making the first 6-7 holds in a range is the hardest. And once you have 6 or 7, you're like sort of like, okay, this is the idea. And then it's like very quick. How long it takes to get it from shaping to production, it just varies on how the production, the factories are, you know, like how busy they are. I've shaped, like in the last 13 months, I shaped, I think, 900 shapes. And
whoa.
Yeah, I did a lot. But I think they're not all out yet. And some of them are shaped in August already. It's just such a long process because they have to go through like the molding process. And then once that is done, you know, there's all these other processes. And then in the end, they have to go to a photo studio. And then like photos have to be edited. They have to be put on a website. And it's just like, it takes like the holds. Once I'm done with the shaping, it's going to take a long time before the holds are actually in the gym. So, but it all varies, obviously.
Yeah. So like a few months to a year, I guess.
A year is a lot, but yeah. Like I think the most I've had is probably like 6-7 months. Yeah.
Also, wait, I'm confused about shaping 900 holds. Like they're all different, like shapes?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they're all different shapes. Yeah. I was shaping for, how many brands did I shape for this year? 6 or 7. I was also like, I get very obsessed with stuff. And when I was a kid, I got obsessed with climbing. And then at some point I was like, okay, because I was working with 360 like a lot. And then I was like, okay, shaping is cool. And I sort of got was like, I rented out like an old garage and just, I was like, for 3 years I was sort of just like copying other holds just to sort of get the idea of the work that you have to do. And like this year I was sort of, okay, I'm going to make 1,000 holds just so I can perfect my craft. That's just sort of like, I'm going to be training more than anybody else.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think like some of the shapers that, there's not a lot of shapers in the world, but some of them have been shaping for, you know, 30 years or whatever. And I'm sort of like, okay, I'm not going to catch up to them in years, but I might as well do like three times as much they do in a year and sort of like do 3 years a year. So I just kept saying yes to all those different like shaping jobs.
Makes sense. But I guess I'm just like confused about the logistics. Like, are these all different shapes?
Imagine this. Like, imagine I'm going to give you a very plastic example. Imagine you're creating a whole range that looks like apples, right? You know the theme is going to be apples, right? An apple. This is how the hole is going to look like. And then you go through the process. Okay, I'm going to need 30-foot holes. Okay, I'm going to put them in three ranges of 10-foot holes. So you create 30 small apples. And then you're like, okay, I need 15 mini jugs. You're like, okay, I need half of them have to be left hand, half of them have to be right hand. So you're changing the shape slightly, like you're getting like they're getting bigger, smaller, like higher profile, lower profile, slopey, juggy, whatever. So the idea is the same the whole time. You're creating a range called apples, but you're kind of changing how the holds look like, sort of like size wise and grip wise.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. It just sounds like a lot. Like, I feel like gyms don't even have 900 holds from like all different brands. So
you're so wrong.
Yeah, so I have no idea, clearly. I have no idea. This is like blowing my mind.
Please go to a like hold brand website today.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're not obsessing about holds anyway, but like I'm sure you have like a particular hold that you like or like a range. Like, go to that brand's website and look at how many different holds there is in a range. And then they all look quite similar. And maybe you're not even going to look like you're not going to notice they're different, but they're very different.
Yeah, I'll have to do some research. Because I guess when you're saying holds, you're not just thinking of like the flagship or like standout holds. You're also just talking small like foot chips or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking about everything, you know, from the smallest chips, like to the biggest fiberglass macros, and yeah.
I'll have to take a look at that. So do you have any like hold hot takes? Any thoughts on like no-tex holds or like the worst holds, worst materials?
I don't like to talk shit about like shapes. From the reason, because I know how hard it is to come up with something new or how hard shaping is. If you've been through the process, it's just like, this is just a heinous process. And if I don't like something, it doesn't mean someone else is not going to like it. So obviously, I think there's some bad stuff on the market. But yeah, so I don't have like a worst hold in my life. But in terms of like no-tex, I think it was a cool idea. Like when they came up with them in Bern at the World Championships, where it's just like such a shock to the athletes. They also just like, they're doing their job, right? They were created for sort of like paddles and sort of, they were created with an idea in mind. Like they know what they wanted to achieve with those holds, and they work really well for those things. I'm not a fan of now all the other brands doing no-tex holds. I just think that's like, okay, I don't think we need more of them. Because like last year at the trade show in Europe, like most of the brands had no-tex holds. Like, I don't think gyms need more of that. Basically, those holds, it's like you're going to stick to them more if your hands are moist. And like, we've seen athletes, you know, lick their hands at comps to get more friction on it. Not sure if that's the best thing to do. And a lot of the times, it's just like, not my favorite holes, but I'm very impressed with the fact that they came up with them. I think they do their job. Just like the creative process behind this is just something I can respect, definitely. I don't think more bands need to do it. It's been done. It's okay. It's not, I don't think an average gym needs them. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you're not going to make any no-tex holds for your brand?
I don't think so. Or no, let me rephrase that. Maybe an average gym needs 10 of those, but they don't need a no-tex hold from every single brand on the planet.
What is the use other than, I guess, just like paddles when you're setting?
You can set everything with them, huh? They're just, you use them as holds. It's just like that. They don't have friction. They were originally meant as this like sort of electric, new modern style products. But obviously you can use them for everything else as well. You can set the V0 with them. Why not? I don't think it's the best idea. Yeah. And you put them in a slab. They're all jugs. You put them on a slab, put them 20 centimeters apart and it's a V0. So.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know if I'd feel comfortable doing a full V0 no-tex climb.
I didn't say it's a good idea. I said it's possible.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. All right. So I think those are all my questions. We can move into some of the Discord questions now. Some setting and hold shaping stuff. So the first one, how do you see route setting and World Cup comps changing over the next decade? Do you think there will be an evolution in styles or like specialized climbing holds that competitors have like never touched before? Do you think there will be any dramatic changes?
I don't know what's dramatic for you, but I think we'll sort of see more and more complex movement like when this whole parkour style came out. It was all like running on huge volumes, jumping on jugs and stuff, just trying to get as far as possible. I think we're sort of going away from that. I think in the future, there'll be a lot of coordination, but on like bad holds, I think the ending positions are going to be more precise. I hope we're going to go more in again. In terms of not having, you know, boulders that are 12 meters wide. Like more complex on worse holds. Also, I think like talking to some of the IFSC setters, I feel like we might be going back to more power stuff, which is good. I feel like a round should test the climber in all of the climbing aspects, in all of the styles. But it is, you know, like in a finals round, you only have four boulders. So in reality, you have to choose all the climbing types that you're going to test them on. I feel like right now we're sort of like every comp has the same four or five different skills that the comps are sort of like questioning or, you know, I feel like we maybe go the tiny bit like away from that. We introduce more styles in. I hope the setting will make it possible for the best all-around climber to win comps. And you can't say the best climber isn't winning right now. I think the best climber is winning, but the best climber in the styles that are presented is winning. And I'm not saying like it wouldn't be the same people winning. I'm just like, maybe let's introduce more styles.
I guess, what do you mean by like wanting it to be more like inwards?
It's just the size of the boulders. Like sometimes you'd see something ridiculous where it's like.
But why does that bother you?
Because I think it's very personal, but I don't like moves that are hard just because they're long. Mm-hmm. Sort of like a run across 8 volumes where you jump from a really big jug to a really big jug in the end. I think that's testing just one part of climbing. I think it should rather be running over three volumes where the starting position is bad and the ending position is bad. Because I feel like that sort of tests more things. Yes, it tests your coordination, but it also tests whether you're strong enough to pull from like bad holds and whether you're like your balance is good enough to end the move in a weird position. So you get more aspects tested than just like having like this gigantic moves.
Okay, makes sense. And so in terms of like your hold shaping and setting, does your setting inspire your hold shaping more, or does your hold shaping inspire your setting more?
I think it feeds off each, you know, off each other. It's just like when I'm setting, I'm thinking about shaping. When I'm shaping, I'm thinking about setting. So it's sort of like a connected thing that just, for me, like one doesn't work without the others, probably. I could probably be setting if I wasn't a shaper. But yeah, it's just, I get the inspiration in shaping and in setting. So yeah.
I guess, is there any time when you're setting where you're like, oh, I really wish I had this kind of hold, and then you have to be the one to make it?
Yeah, but it's not necessarily about like the outline or the shape of the holds. I would like, sometimes I would think about, well, what kind of a grip would I need here? You know, like, well, it'd be really cool if you had like a sloper that's kind of positive, but not really, or, you know, whatever. I'm just, and then sometimes I'm like, oh, I wish I had this like really high profile thing that would be this size and this. So yeah, I do think about the shapes a lot. When setting.
Okay, next question. More general, I guess. What's it like climbing with Janja?
It's just impressive. Mm-hmm. It's just, like last year before Paris, just like every day, because we train together like most of the days, and every day I was just like watch her climb and be like, well, this is the perfect climber. There's nothing else you can do. This is, you know, like, you can't get better. And yet every day she gets better.
Just in terms of like training or like the, I don't know what she's
doing. It's everything. It's like power, tactics, endurance, the style, technique, everything. I'll remember like she'd do like 70, 80 move circuits on a spray wheel. And she would do them. I'll be like, well, those are some of the hardest moves. And she just did 80 of them. I guess she does, like, you can't get better. And then she'd jump down and she'd be like, pugh. And then the coach would be like, what do you think? She's like, well, I could have done this better. And he's like, yes, and this. So it's just like, it's mind blowing. Yeah, it's also, at first I had like a problem training with her, because it's just like it can be really demoralizing.
Okay, yeah.
But and then we had a period when we didn't train together that much, because I wasn't working for neither of us. But like last years we trained together, and I kind of switched from fuck, she's much better than me, to being like, well, she's this good, I can learn from her, and I'm pretty sure I can be this strong. And I feel like this, it made me, I think I was the strongest ever in my last year. It didn't show in the results, which sucks, but I feel like physically I was in best shape in my last year. Because I was just like, that. I was like, this is what I want. she's just like, she's ridiculously good. It's what you see at comps is not even close to being an estimation how good she actually is.
That's good to know. I guess when you said that sometimes it would feel like demoralizing training with her, I don't know. How do you like get over that feeling?
Yes, like I said, it's just like you have to get over it and be like, okay, she's better, but let's just learn from her. It's the same as training with anyone who's better than you. It's just like, well, you either cry about it and you don't train with them, or you're like, they're good, I'm going to train with them, get as good as them.
you said that your training styles were like kind of different, and so you also didn't really train together because of that. It kind of like also reminded me of what you said about like training with your brother in terms of like different training styles. Like, in what way do you want training styles to be like similar so that you would train with someone?
With Yanni, it was different. I think it was just sort of like, I think we're both pretty hard people to train, like to coach, sorry. Obviously, very different level. She's greatest of all time. I'm not comparing myself to her. But it's just like we do both get like super annoyed with ourselves. We get like annoying, like really annoying.
Okay.
And I think there was a point where we would get annoying at the same times, and we would get annoyed to each other, like with each other, and it just didn't work. But I think it was mostly because I was just frustrated not being as good as her. But in terms of like the training partner, I think for me, we're just like to walk into the gym and train with someone who just sort of like lifts you up. And then if you have like two people that are just so psyched to get better, it's just like they don't even need to be training on the same boulders, training on the same routes, whatever. They don't need to be doing the same thing, but just having like two training partners that are just like so psyched to get better is just like gonna bring, you know, the motivation up.
Yeah,
I was sort of thinking about this the other day when now Jungwon Chan and his brother Jaejun were in Slovenia training.
Oh, nice.
And I live like 5 minutes away from the gym, so almost every day I'll walk in to, you know, say hi to everyone and drink coffee with them. And with them, Janja and Anzhep Behart's training. And like, I was sitting there sipping coffee. Like, I was there for 45 minutes. I was like, this is the first time I actually missed training hard, because the psych was so high. Everyone was just like pushing each other so much. Just like that. And that's exactly the training environment I think you need to succeed. Yeah.
And what's like you said that you learned a lot from her. Is there anything that really stands out to you in terms of things you learned?
I think her try hard is nobody tries as hard as her. Yeah.
How did you like incorporate that into your own training? Just like the psych of trying hard?
I think I'm not a very talented climber. I don't think I ever was. I think I'm the one thing that I was sort of good at is, trying hard. But I kind of lost it there for a second for a couple of years. But what trying hard feels to me is just like every time you get on the wall, it's just like you push yourself just a tiny bit more than you thought it could be possible. And after like training with her for like a long time, I was like always like, okay, but she just gives so much more. And I was thinking about that a lot, so I like consciously tried to push it more. But it's very hard to put it in words, but yeah, just like every move you do that feels on the limit, you give more than you could possibly do. And it's funny, like I've talked to one of the coaches in the Slovenian team. I was like, I feel like if you try hard, one move can wear you down so much that you're going to feel it in like 3 days. Like one try on one move. If you really try hard, if you really push your body.
I wonder if I try hard. I don't know. I got to think about it.
I don't want to be mean, but I'm sure you're not.
Yeah.
I think most people don't. Like, I genuinely think that most people don't. Yeah.
I think I've gotten better at it, but it was really bad before. Yeah. Last question anyway. This one came from Matt, so I wonder if this is just like macro. So I just wonder if it's I don't know. Maybe he's just trolling. He just says, "How can I be like you?"
I think he's just trolling.
Yeah. Are you guys close? Or?
I mean, we've gotten closer, because of all the traveling. And I think he's cool. We're friends. And it's cool having him around in the circuit.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever, like, co-commentate World Cups?
I'm not sure if I've ever done it with Matt. I've done it with Charlie.
Oh, really?
When Charlie was still around. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not a lot. I don't think people should be listening to me on streams. I don't think my English is good enough to be.
Oh, that's not true. That's not true at all.
But, yeah, I think you should be professional doing it. So I don't think it's the best idea to have athletes, and even though I think there is a certain element that the athletes can bring. But yeah, I didn't like doing it that much.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I mean, you commentated a bit for the, I forget what it was, just for like some of the competitions you had set recently, right?
Oh, yeah, Doc Masters. But that wasn't really commentating, was it? It was just more talking about setting and boulders. And it wasn't like on the stream speaking about climbing. I don't think my brain works fast enough to do that job. So.
Oh, really? Okay. Okay, cool. Well, I think that's all the questions I had then. Do you have any like final thoughts or words of wisdom you want to get out there?
I don't think I'm wise enough to give words of wisdom.
Oh, come on. I feel like you've been saying that a lot, that you're not good at whatever and whatever else. But I mean, come on. You got to have a little something.
Train harder. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, that's all I had for today. Thanks for joining me. You want to let people know where they can find you?
I'm in the gym most of the time now.
Yeah.
Other than that, I'm on Instagram.
I will link that in the description. Well, awesome. Thank you again. And it was amazing to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for making it to the end of the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you enjoyed. Otherwise, you are a super big climber. If you're listening on a podcasting platform, I'd appreciate if you rate it 5 stars, and you can continue the discussion on the free competition climbing Discord linked in the description. Thanks again for listening. We'll